This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 283 was recorded on August 4th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Santiago Capital founder and private wealth manager Brent Johnson returns as this week's feature interview guest. Brent says the U.S. dollar isn't really crashing to zero, as some have suggested, then goes on to articulate a balanced view on the inflation-deflation debate. We'll also discuss commodities, including precious metals, and why Brent thinks soft commodities in particular may be a good play if prices pull back. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick's chart deck is titled Big Picture Look at Commodities.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's jump to that S&P 500. Literally nothing has changed from last week. I mean, it's almost like if it was a gamma pin, yet we're not at an OPEX. We're just trading sideways. And while the trend is very well established to the upside, it certainly doesn't seem to be going anywhere in a hurry. Any insights? Is this just summer doldrums?
I think it's summer doldrums. I mean, it's not going anywhere to the upside in a hurry, but it's still holding the five-day moving average and all the other longer moving averages below it. So we're definitely still in uptrend conditions. The valuations still don't make sense to me, but I think it's a crack-up boom, and I think it's likely to continue.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index. We are still holding above the 92 level, 92 and a quarter at the time of recording here. And obviously, the dollar's been relatively strong since June. You think that trend can continue?
Well, Brent Johnson is the man for this subject. We've had quite a few discussions with Brent about the dollar over the years, so I want to leave a lot of this to him. But really, no change in my view. We're consolidating. Until there's a close below 89 or well above the recent highs, I think it's just a sideways consolidation. Frankly, I think the reason for that consolidation is too many people are confused about the fact that the dollar index is, in fact, a relative measure of the dollar against other fiat currencies, not an absolute measure. And I think that has a lot to do with why there's so much confusion and volatility in the market.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil, because to end last week, I mean, crude oil was approaching its previous highs, looked like the trend was resuming. And we came into this week with nothing but selling, and we're under some pretty key levels, and specifically under $70 back down here. What's your take on the price action? And more importantly, how did the inventory numbers come in?
Well, my prior prognostications of $80 to $92 by Labor Day on front month WTI were based entirely on a cacophony of analysts that were forecasting up to 20 million barrels per week of average drawdowns in August. Well, guess what? August is here, and the very first August print was not a drawdown at all, but a build of 3.6 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 543,000 barrels. We did still see a drawdown on gasoline of 5.3 million barrels. That's a significant drawdown, but to still it's only drawing down 832,000 barrels. Still on the net, it is overall a drawdown on crude plus finished products, but nowhere close to the 20 million barrels a week that some analysts had predicted. Now, of course, one print doesn't make a trend, but this is the second week in a row that we've missed expectations of really big drawdowns and seen either small drawdowns or, in this case, a significant build instead. If that continues through the rest of August, all bets on much higher numbers are off. I'm not persuaded yet, but definitely this is interesting. Now, I think the Delta strain is confusing the market. Definitely, everybody is looking at this and saying, for good reason, well, wait a minute, look at China really starting to shut things down. China is a huge consumer of oil. If their demand is going down, it's going to bring the price down. And that's very real. But I think there's also a lot of fear in the system about, oh boy, the Delta strain could mean that we're going to shut the whole economy down and it's going to crash to negative prices like it did last year. I just don't see that as being in the cards, Patrick. Meanwhile, U.S. production stayed unchanged at 11.2 2 million barrels. Where do we go from here? I think it really depends on what happens next with inventory in coming weeks. The recipe that was going to get us, and I still think it could get us above $80 before Labor Day, was about a series of really significant inventory drawdowns. That doesn't happen. We may have already seen that the peak price is in for this year.
All right. Well, let's touch on gold, because gold was making a pretty good press this morning toward 1840, and then certainly has kind of come off a little bit. But overall, gold is holding in here north of 1800. Do you think gold can resume its prior uptrend, or is this just more of a gold being stuck in the mud?
Well, we're stuck in the mud consolidating here, and the support is on the short-term moving averages. 5, 8, 13, 21, 34-day moving averages are all right around where the market is or just below it. Meanwhile, resistance has been strong where the 55 and 200-day moving averages are co-located right around 1836. So if you see a closing print below 1800, that would take it below all of the short-term moving averages. That says maybe more numbers to the downside are coming. If you see that daily close above 1840, for that matter, above 1837, that would suggest that maybe the resolution is to the upside. I still think the upside resolution is most likely, but so far, at least this week, the numbers aren't really cooperating with us. We saw a little bit of a tease this morning, but it all retraced pretty quickly.
All right, and let's wrap things up by looking at the 10-year Treasury yield, because late July, we put in lows near around 115, and it looked like maybe yields hit a short-term low. But after just a quick little several-day bounce, they rolled right over, and here we are under 120 again on that 10-year yield. I mean, that trend is pretty pronounced on the downside. Do you think we have lower yields from here still?
I think we probably do. You know, 1.34 was a key technical number that once that didn't hold as support, I think that we're probably headed toward lower yields. But frankly, I don't really have a strong conviction view here because we're already at super low yields. And who knows what's coming next in terms of monetary and fiscal policy. I think to trade this market, you've got to have a much stronger understanding and stronger conviction than I have about where monetary and fiscal policy are both headed. And frankly, I think it's a political circus that's hard to interpret. Let's ask Brent Johnson, though. This is certainly something he focuses on.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Santiago Capital founder Brent Johnson. Now, Eric, why did we invite Brent back on the show this week?
Well, Patrick, Brent is one of our favorite guys, the kind of guy we got to get back at least every 6 months. And we said, oh boy, we're overdue. It's been longer than that. And frankly, it's perfect timing to get him back because this inflation deflation debate is one where Brent has been identified as a deflationist, although he'll tell you in this interview, he doesn't really like that label because he sees both arguments. So we're going to get a very balanced view, I think, and one I found quite interesting. I think you'll really enjoy this interview.
Well, Eric's interview with Brent Johnson is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas Neo in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas Neo or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Santiago Capital founder Brent Johnson. Brent prepared an excellent slide deck for today's interview, and I strongly encourage you to download it, as we will be referring to the charts and graphs it contains during today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not registered yet at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads. Brent, it has been way too long since we've had you on the show. It's great to have you back. Let's jump into your slide deck and talk about a favorite topic of mine when I talk to you, the U.S. dollar. Everybody's asking me. I can't decide.
Well, I had a feeling you might ask me about the dollar, Eric, so that was the first slide that I threw in here. But in any case, it's really great to be back. I always appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and your listeners. It's one of my favorite podcasts out there, so happy to jump in. And you know, the point I wanted to make with this first slide here is I was here talking with you about a year ago, Eric, and the dollar was around 93. You know, and since that time, I've had innumerable people tell me, remind me, try to convince me that the dollar is going to zero and there's just nothing that can stop it. However, you know, in the last year, despite printing over $1.4 trillion, despite having a Democratic president get elected, despite having a totally Democratic Congress get elected, despite numerous stimulus plans, contested elections, and social unrest, the dollar's at 92. So I guess I would say, are you sure? Are you sure the dollar's going to zero? I'll tell you, I'm not sure about anything, Eric, but I think it's a very uncertain time. And I think a lot of people who are certain in their narratives may be proven wrong. And so we'll just have to see how it goes.
Brent, let's talk about some of those reasons that some people say the dollar is going to zero. You know, this has frankly baffled me because the usual argument I hear is, hey, look, governments are just debasing fiat currency. And I mean, it's a huge trend. Well, I couldn't possibly agree more with that. But the dollar index is a relative measure of the dollar against other fiat currencies where those other governments are doing the same stuff. So why don't we go ahead, looking at slide four here, I see you've got kind of the history of the various different programs of quantitative easing that everybody thought was going to crash the dollar. What is this chart telling us and what should we make from it?
The point I wanted to get across was that I don't disagree when people tell me that governments are debasing the currencies and it's a trick as old as time and you can't trust the governments and they're going to do everything they can to, you know, inflate away the debt. Of course, they're going to try to do that. But are they going to be successful? They may be successful against things like land and gold and other real assets. But again, to your point, fiat currencies are relative. And think about all the different programs and everything they've tried over the last, you know, 12 or 13 years since the global financial crisis. Well, you know, the dollar is higher today than it was when they started in 2008. So despite QE1, despite QE2, despite Operation Twist, despite QE3, despite the repo crisis in 2019, and despite COVID, over the last, you know, call it 12 to 15 months, the dollar's higher than it was in 2008. So, you know, and then I'll hear people say, well, it doesn't really matter. Fiat levels don't matter. And the point I would make is relative fiat levels absolutely do matter. Now, if you want to just put 100% of your money into gold or Bitcoin or one asset, well, then just go that buy that one asset and go to the beach. You don't have any more work to do. But if you don't want to have all of your money in one asset, you very much need to understand how fiat currencies trade relative to each other, because it has huge implications for markets.
Brent, talk me through the next few slides. Why hasn't the dollar crashed the way so many people thought it would?
Well, again, I think, you know, it goes back to the relative level of currency. If this was a unique situation to the United States, if we were the only one that had committed these egregious fiscal sins, and we were the only ones who were trying to inflate away our debt and having to provide stimulus programs and thinking about MMT policies and UBI, then, of course, you know, I would expect the dollar to fall. But it's just not the case. You know, everybody likes to point out the Fed this, the Fed that. And that the Fed is, quote unquote, monetizing the debt, even though they're not calling it that. But, you know, what about the ECB? I mean, last year, the ECB monetized 85% of the net Eurozone issuance, and they're on schedule to do over 100% this year. So, again, how come people aren't laying all the world's problems at the feet of the ECB? Why is it always the Fed? Again, the Fed is not alone. And then they'll say, you know, going forward, you know, the Fed is monetizing most of the debt, and it's all going to be sitting on the Fed's balance sheet. The U.S. Treasuries are going to be sitting on the Fed's balance sheet. Again, I don't necessarily disagree. But again, why aren't they talking about the United Kingdom? Why aren't they talking about Australia? Why aren't they talking about Canada, Europe, and Japan? All of those countries have dramatically higher percentages of their outstanding treasuries on their balance sheets. So again, this is a relative game, and we're not the only ones doing it. And as a result, I think people are going to be surprised at the dollar's resilience. And I think we are still set up for the possibility for the dollar to go much higher. Now, that's not a guarantee. I don't know that that's going to happen. But I think all these people who are just sure of themselves that the dollar's headed to zero may be dramatically disappointed.
Brent, we've covered your dollar milkshake before on Macro Voices, but it's been quite a while. Let's do a quick refresher for any new listeners. What do you mean dollar milkshake here on page 10?
Yeah, so on 10, the point that I've made is that, you know, that's the amount of debt that has been issued in the world is going to have consequences. And it's not just the U.S. You know, the whole world has issued massive amounts of debt. But the U.S. is the global reserve currency. So a lot of that debt has taken place in dollars. And that puts a lot of demand under the dollar. You know, so despite the fact that we've been printing a lot, other countries have been printing a lot too. And so I've coined this term that they've created this milkshake of liquidity. However, I believe that all this debt is going to have consequences. Now, it hasn't yet, but you know, and so I will hold up my hand and say I'm absolutely been wrong as far as the timing of a global sovereign debt crisis or a currency crisis. But I still believe that's coming because I still believe that debt has consequences. And I believe when we enter this currency crisis and this debt crisis, I believe the dollar will, for many reasons, be the last man standing. And I think as that happens, the dollar will suck up the global liquidity, hence the dollar milkshake. Now, if we enter a global monetary crisis and a global sovereign crisis or a currency crisis, and the dollar falls rather than rises, then I will hold up my hand again and say, you know what, the theory is wrong. I got it wrong. But until we get into that crisis and see how that crisis plays out, we just don't really know. Again, this is I always remind people, I call this the dollar milkshake theory. It's not called the dollar milkshake fact. It's not called the dollar milkshake guarantee. I don't know for sure how this is going to play out, but my suspicions tell me that when this happens, when we get into this event or when we get into this time period where global debt actually does matter, I think you're going to see a rapidly appreciating U.S. dollar.
Let's move on to the topic I've been asking all of our guests recently, which is inflation versus deflation. Janet says it's transitory. Don't worry about it. And President Biden says you don't have to worry about inflation because we're going to pump money into the economy, which will make the inflation go away. That's a macro view I'm not really familiar with. What do you make of this?
Well, I do think that this is kind of the debate of our time, for lack of a better word. You know, I would say this. I have been labeled a deflationist, and I don't necessarily mind that, although I would say that I feel like I could flip to the other side pretty quickly if I see a few things happen. Part of the reason that I've been, you know, put into the deflation camp is for my strong dollar views. And typically, a rising dollar is kind of associated with the deflationary pressures. I would say that over the last kind of 12 to 15 months, you know, after COVID broke out and we've had the central bank reaction to it and the monetary authority reaction to it, I'm not going to sit here and deny that prices haven't risen. You know, sometimes people will say to me, Brent, how can you not see the inflation? The short answer is I can see it. It's pretty clear that prices have risen. The question I have is whether they continue to rise and if they continue to rise at the same rate at which they've been rising. I am of the belief that in addition to just what the central banks have done, a big reason for the rise in prices has been the supply chain disruption. And I think some of that will get worked out. Now, it's not going to get worked out overnight, and I am not so naive to think that it's all going to be perfect tomorrow. But I do think a lot of that will get eventually worked out. And I also think that a lot of the upside that we've seen for the last 15 months is starting to subside. And I think that the biggest near-term worry is deflation rather than inflation. Again, I don't know this for sure, but I think there's a few things that we can look at to tell us whether inflation is sustainable or whether it's transitory. And I've put a few charts up here that I know you've seen before, Eric, so we've talked about them before, and you know some other your guests have talked about them before. But on slide 12, I've laid out the rate or the commercial and industrial loans. And what you see is last year, once they rolled out the PPP loans and the loans that the banks gave were guaranteed by the government, well, then the banks were happy to lend. But as soon as those programs ended, you immediately saw commercial and industrial loans start to fall. And they've fallen, with the exception of 1 or 2 months, they've fallen every month since then. I think in order to get sustained inflation, again, I'm not going to argue about whether we've had inflation for the last 15 months, but to get sustained inflation going forward, we really need the banks to lend, because that's where the money supply has really increased. And they are just currently, they just aren't doing so. I also talk about on page 13 that in order to get, again, sustained inflation going forward, we really need wages to rise. And again, they had a big jump last year, and now, and since then, they've just kind of crashed back down to the long-term trend. And, you know, long story short, wages just are not yet doing so. Now, again, if this last chart that I showed and then this chart, if we start to see some sustained changes, I'm happy to consider the fact that maybe inflation is here to stay. But so far, the data is telling me that that's not necessarily the case. You know, and that's why, you know, we still have such a low velocity of money. I kind of point this out on slide 14 here, Eric. It still sits at its all-time lows, or at least near its all-time lows. I struggle to understand how we're going to have sustainable runaway inflation if money just isn't moving.
Now, you said the real issue was banks needed to start lending in order for inflation to be possible. It seems to me like, boy, the political sentiment is really growing in favor of universal basic income, forgiveness of college debt, you know, a whole bunch of things. Isn't that enough to get inflation going? Or do you really think there has to be bank lending to create more M1 money supply?
Well, you can get some inflationary pressures from some of these programs that you're talking about. But to get the sustained high levels of inflation that we've seen for the last year, then I think you do need lending. Because you got to remember, all of these programs that are, you know, whether it's UBI or these PPP checks, they don't just come out of nowhere. At the same time they're created, debt is created. And the bigger the debt grows, the more deflationary pressure it puts on the economy. So you have to figure out a way to, you know, get more money coming in than the debt that's created along with it. And, you know, that's a big part of bank lending. When a company sells a bond, right, when a company or a country, when they issue bonds and, you know, the people go out and buy those bonds, they're taking money out of the system that already exists in order to buy those bonds. But when bank lending happens, when bank loans are created, that's new money. That's new money that's going into the system. It's not a recycling of the current system or the current supply. And so I think, you know, there's no doubt that when a government spends money, you do get a short-term inflationary impact. The question is it enough to offset the additional debt or that country or company has incurred as well? And I think that without getting some lending, you know, it just doesn't happen. And again, you got to ask yourself, the banks probably understand the banking system better than most people, right? They're the ones closest to the money. You got to kind of ask yourself, if we have such this great opportunity of growth coming up, why are the banks not lending to try to participate in it? Why are they instead buying treasury bonds and sitting on them? I think that that's a good place to look and see whether the banks really believe we're in an inflationary environment or a deflationary environment. And when I look at what they're doing, they're buying bonds. They're not making loans. So I struggle to see without a few things changing. And again, I'm open to them changing, but without a few things changing, I struggle to see the sustained inflation that so many are convinced is here.
Tell me about your reaction on page 16 to the commodity prices, because boy, you know, there's a pretty strong confirmation of an inflation perspective just from that.
Well, again, there's no doubt that commodities have had a huge run over the last year. They have made, you know, big moves. Many of them have broken out from long-term, you know, bearish patterns, for lack of a better word. Some of them are moving towards either recent highs or all-time highs. But again, you know, you're starting to see some of these economic forecasts fall short. Just the other day, you know, GDP was forecast to come in at like 8% and it came in at a little over 6. So you're already starting to see some of these economic growth prospects to get pulled back. In addition to that, you know, you've seen a number of these commodities, like copper had a huge move, lumber had a huge move, but you know, those have pulled back anywhere from 5 to 20%. And so some of these really, really inflationary, you know, commodities, you're starting to see a pullback. Now, I think we have to kind of wait and see how the next 6 months go. I tend to believe that the biggest risk near term is deflation rather than inflation. But to your point, Eric, you can't ignore charts like this when they're going up that fast. So I don't think they can continue to go up at the same rate they've gone for the last year, but we'll just have to kind of wait and see how the data comes in.
Brent, one of the things I love about your work is you're really good at taking these macro views and translating them to actionable advice in terms of portfolio construction. I see on page 18, looks like you've got a picture here of a guy who's trying to figure out inflation versus deflation.
Well, yeah, and I think, I have a picture of a guy named Chris Moneymaker. And Chris Moneymaker kind of came onto the scene 15 or 20 years ago. He was one of the first guys to grow up playing online poker, who then, you know, translated that skill into playing real poker, real live pro poker, and won the World Series of Poker. And I think that was good in many ways, because I think you can learn a lot from studying poker players. But there was one thing that I think that was bad with this advent of online poker, and then, you know, also having poker on TV and people knowing the names of these professional poker players. Because one of the most famous lines, for lack of a better word, that goes along with poker is saying, "I'm all in," right? And so, you know, somebody thinks they have a good hand. They see their favorite poker player on TV pushing all their chips into the middle of the table. That's kind of an exciting prospect. You know, we're going to get rich. We got the hand here, and we're pushing it all in. And on the one hand, while I like that, you know, I think it's dangerous as well. And I'll tell you why, because, you know, I like playing poker, Eric, and I'm an okay poker player. But the reason I'm not a great poker player is I like to play poker. And what I mean by that is, when I play poker, I tend to play more hands than I should because I want to be involved. The reality is professional poker players, the really, really good poker players, they play less than 20% of the hands that are dealt. They just sit there and they wait and they wait and they wait and they wait for the cards to come to them. And occasionally they will bluff. But usually when you see a poker player start making big bets, he has the cards. And because he's waited and he's been patient. And I think this is a big mistake that a lot of people make with portfolio construction these days. I think a lot of people go all in on a hunch, or they go all in when they have a pair of eights, right? Or maybe they have three of a kind. But I think people are going all in. You should not be going all in unless you have at least a full house and maybe a straight flush, right? But unfortunately, people get excited, they want to play, and they go all in on a pair of threes. And I just think that's the wrong thing to do. The other thing I should say is I always try to remind people, when you hear somebody, you know, whether it's me coming on and talking on a podcast like this, or you're watching some other person on CNBC, or you're reading a report, you have to put yourself in that person's shoes and understand what it is that they do. You know, I am not a day trader. I'm not somebody who comes in and I'm whipping positions around constantly. What I do is I create customized long-term portfolios. And so what I mean by that is I develop a basket of assets for my clients that are customized to them. And then for the most part, we sit there and we wait for those assets to appreciate over time. Because if you look at the arc of history, assets appreciate over time. And then when we see a really good opportunity, then we'll go in and be aggressive. But we're not always trading, you know. And I think sometimes when you hear somebody say, or when I've come on before and I've said, you know, I think gold's going to go down over the next year, that doesn't mean that I'm rushing out to sell my gold. It doesn't mean that I've got a huge gold short position. It just means that I would not be surprised if gold pulls back. So my point is I think when you're constructing a portfolio, it's important to figure out, you know, what you're trying to accomplish and over what time period. I feel like there's a lot of certainty in the market right now. And I feel like this is a time of great uncertainty. And so I think, you know, when you're listening to somebody or when you're looking at your own portfolio, figure out what it is you're trying to accomplish. You do not have to be a day trader. Now, if you are a day trader, that's fine. But make sure that if you're listening to somebody's advice, you're listening to somebody who has kind of the same objective or the same mindset as you. So I don't know if that's a good answer or not, Eric. I kind of went on a little bit of a ramble there, but I think that's kind of why I put these slides in here.
So you're not going all in on silver, which is guaranteed to go to 1,000 according to Wall Street Bets?
I think that when I saw that earlier this year in February, when everybody's like piling into silver because Wall Street Bets was going to take it higher, I was just, I knew that that was not going to end well. And I still think that silver probably goes lower before it goes higher. But yeah, but to your point, Eric, you know, it's okay to have a silver position, but you don't need to go all in, right? It's just, even if you think it's going up to 1,000, if it goes up to 1,000, you don't need to be all in. Put 5% of your portfolio, and if it goes to 1,000, you're going to be really happy. So I think it's about position sizing and understanding what it is you're trying to accomplish.
Well, Brent, we've got a slide coming up later in the deck on gold, so I'll wait till the slide for that one. But why don't we move on to page 22, where you start to talk about an allocation or a portfolio allocation?
So yeah, so I put this slide in here, Eric, because this is not specific advice to anyone in particular, but as a general state of what I think is an appropriate portfolio for a long-term investor is to have a very diversified approach. You know, about 15 or 16 months ago, kind of in the middle of the COVID pandemic crisis, someone was suggesting to me that they should have 50 to 100% of their portfolio in gold. And I just didn't think that's the right way to go. And I suggested this portfolio as a good way to be prepared for anything should it come down the pike. Now, I'm very, very bullish on gold long term, but I don't think that you should have 50 to 100% of your portfolio in gold. I just don't think that's the right way to do it. And so, you know, I think the point I'm trying to make here is if you have a portfolio such as the one that I suggest on page 22, you're kind of ready for anything, whether you get inflation or deflation, whether you get a war, a revolution, a boom, a bust, you're going to be able to get through it. And then if you have some kind of a macro or a volatility overlay that takes it, you know, can take advantage when you get these crises, or if you can convert some of your short and medium term U.S. treasuries into cash and then go buy some equities that have been beat up in a crisis, you can actually, you know, you can take advantage when you see the real opportunity. But the point is to have a diversified portfolio. Don't go all in on anything. And then when you see a really amazing opportunity, then that's when you go all in, or that's not when you go on, but that's when you make a more aggressive bet. And so, you know, I know, because I've been so outspoken on the dollar, a lot of people think that I only own dollar. And so because the dollar's gone down over the last year, all we've done is lose money. But, you know, the dollar is just one piece of what we do. I mean, I have clients that have owned equities for 15 or 20 years. We've owned gold forever. They all own big chunks of real estate. We focused our equities kind of on big blue chip U.S. equities. Those have been fantastic over the last year. And if you had this portfolio that I suggest here, and even if the global macro and the volatility got cut in half or even went down by 60 or 70% over the last year, this portfolio still would have made money. And so my point is that you don't need to go all in on everything. I know I've said that a few times, but I just can't emphasize that enough. I think people go all in way too much. I think this is a time of great uncertainty, and I think we have a bull market uncertainty despite the fact that it's a very uncertain time.
Brent, let's talk in detail about some of these asset classes that you're recommending allocation to. I see on page 24, you've got the 10-year U.S. Treasury. Where are we headed in terms of Treasury yields?
Well, so this kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about whether the next move is inflationary or deflationary. I'll tell you, Eric, the bond market certainly doesn't think that inflation is raging. You know, if you look at this chart, you can see that, you know, other than the pandemic, when we had a massive move lower in yields, you know, last year, and then a huge run up, we just now broke back through support that goes all the way back to 2012. So, you know, when you're sitting here and you're thinking how great this economy is and that we've got all this growth and inflation is supposedly raging, why is the 10-year treasury sitting just over 1%? I think, you know, I have to laugh because in April, kind of the March, April, May timeframe, when bonds were selling off, and I was saying that I still expected us to have some kind of a disinflationary move, I had several people say to me, listen to the market. Don't try to force anything. The market is telling you that inflation is here. So I think I would turn that around and I would ask those same people who were saying that to me in the spring, you know, what is the market telling you now? Are you listening to the market? Now, again, I don't know for sure what's going to happen, Eric, but when I see yields doing something like this on page 24, and then I look at the long-term trend on page 25, you know, this could go significantly lower. And if the certainty of the inflationary trade starts to come off a little bit, it wouldn't shock me at all to see yields under 1% again.
Is there a lower bound at 0% where it just doesn't make sense for the sovereign debt of the global reserve currency issuing nation to ever go negative? Or is zero just a number on the way to negative numbers?
So I kind of depart from a lot of my, I guess, quote unquote, friends in the deflationary camp on this, because I personally don't think that the U.S. Treasury is going to go negative. Now, it could. It will. If it happens, it will not shock me. But that's not my base case. Part of the reason is I think in a really deflationary environment, you know, the market might take the negative under a very short period of time. But then I think that would force some kind of a reset, for lack of a better word. So I don't think that we would have a multi-year scenario where the global reserve currency is at a negative rate. Now, we've had negative rates on, you know, Swiss and other European and Japanese rates for years now. And that's a little different because it's not the global reserve currency. I don't necessarily think that rates are going to go negative in the U.S. And if they do, I wouldn't expect them to stay there very long. But, you know, it's a very uncertain world. I do think rates are going lower. We'll just kind of have to wait and see what happens when we get close.
Brent, let's come back to gold, a subject that's near and dear to the hearts of many of our listeners. When you and I spoke last, I think we both thought that gold was probably due for some kind of a downside correction. I'm kind of feeling like the bottom's probably in. Didn't get as low as I thought it would, but feels to me like it's over. What do you think?
Well, so about a year ago, you know, I think it's, is it tomorrow or the next day? We will be a year from the high. So I think it was the first week of August of 2020 when gold put in its high at around, right around 2100. I don't know if it quite hit 2100 or not, but it got pretty close. And, you know, at the time, you know, I thought that gold would come back, and it has. It's down, gold's about 10%, down about 10% over the last year. Down 5 or 6% year to date. You know, again, I would say if inflation is just absolutely raging, why is gold, you know, why is it down over the last 12 months? Why is it down year to date? I put on the chart here, we've kind of got this rising wedge, for lack of a better word. It's kind of in the middle of that wedge. I think that it's more likely than not that we'll go back down and at least touch the bottom of that wedge. If we get into some kind of a deflationary environment or disinflationary environment, it wouldn't shock me at all to see it, you know, cut below that, you know, $1,800 level and then, you know, maybe go down to the $1,600 level or something like that. I think, you know, the chances of it going back to $1,200 or $1,000 are pretty low. I think that that's quite unlikely at this point. And part of the reason is that if we get kind of a big deflationary move, gold could certainly be seen as a source of funds for the very short term. But if that happens, then all of a sudden we get negative rates again, right? And actually, negative rates are better for gold than rising rates. You know, part of the reason that gold has sold off year to date is that yields were going higher. You know, until the last month or so here, yields were going higher. But now as we've started to see, yields fall again, you've seen gold start to rise over the last month, let's call it, or over the last few months. And so it's kind of, again, right in the middle of this range. So I do not think that we're going to see gold breaking out to all-time highs this year. Again, I can't rule it out. I still own it. If it does, that'll be fine. But that's not my base case. I would expect gold to I think we've seen the high in gold for the year. I think it what did it get to, 1950 last month or something like that? I think that may have been the high for this year, and we may just kind of trend sideways or down for the rest of the year.
Now, some people would say it's all over for gold because Bitcoin is the new currency debasement hedge. What do you think of that argument, and what are your views on Bitcoin and where it's headed?
So I have been pretty, what's the right way to say this, Eric? I actually like Bitcoin from a personal perspective, but since about last Thanksgiving, I have been very cautious on Bitcoin. And as it ran up from, you know, I've owned Bitcoin for years, and when it hit $28,000 last fall, I sold a little bit. When it hit $38,000, I sold a little bit more. At $48,000, I sold a little bit more. And at $58,000, I sold a little bit more. I didn't quite sell any at $60,000, so I still own a little bit. But I thought it was going to come back. And part of the reason I thought it was going to come back is I was convinced that we were going to start seeing increased measures by either countries or authorities, however you want to describe that, to make moves, not necessarily to make it illegal, but to curb its use or to regulate it, you know, maybe not let it be quite such a wild, wild west. And so that's we've seen that quite a bit over the last 2 or 3 months. And, you know, Bitcoin had a big pullback from, I think, 65,000 to 30,000. I think today it's at around 38. I still think we're going to see it go lower. I'm not buying any. I still own a tiny bit. I've sold most of it. I think it has a place in a portfolio. If somebody wants to own it in their portfolio, I think that's fine. But again, I don't think it's something that you should be all in on. And as far as it replacing gold, I just don't think that that's the case. And again, there's no reason you can't own both. A lot of people try to get into an either or all in scenario, and it's just totally unnecessary to do that. I think it's very likely that as they roll out these central bank digital currencies, which is, you know, about a certain, nothing is certain in this world, but central bank digital currencies coming down the road, that's about as certain as things get. And as those gets rolled out, I would expect, you know, countries, they don't like competition. And I would expect them to push back on crypto and Bitcoin as that happens as well. So I think Bitcoin has a role in a portfolio if you understand the risks. I think Tether is a huge risk to Bitcoin. I will just say that I think that Tether is a fraud. And I think if and when that is exposed, I think that will be, at least in the short term, very negative for the price of Bitcoin. So that's probably why I'm cautious in the short term. But digital assets, tokenization, Bitcoin, they're probably here to stay. It's just a matter of at what level they will be and in what method they're allowed to be used.
Let's take a look at the stock market on page 27. Boy, what a compelling chart here, you know, and I can't help but observe all that huge action to the upside in the S&P really has been driven mostly by the FANG stocks.
That's right. It really has. It really has. And the reason I put this in here, Eric, is you and I spoke in either January or February of 2020. And at the time, you know, we were at 0.1. I've put a yellow circle with a 1 next to it. And at the time, I was saying that I expected a pullback in equities, and I thought that we could go down to the bottom of that red channel. Now, I'm not going to sit here, Eric, and say that I thought that that was going to happen immediately and happen over a period of 3 weeks, right? I was just saying I could see it pull back down towards the bottom of that channel. And that did happen. And so we were pretty lucky. We bought at the bottom of that red channel. It was a scary few days as it went a little lower than that. My mistake was that, you know, once it bounced kind of back up into the middle of that channel and started getting into that green area, I thought we would probably see a retest back down to the, you know, bottom of that channel again. But you know what? It just never came. It's just continued to run higher. And to your point, a lot of it has been driven by the FANG stocks and the technology stocks. And so the reason I've put number 3 on here is so people have heard me talk before. I think equities are going much higher in the years ahead. But I do think before that happens, we are likely to pull back, maybe retest the top of that channel. Now, that would be a 15 or 20% pullback from here, Erica. I don't know that it will come, but I'm certainly not allocating new money to equities right here. And I'm waiting for any cash that we have or to add to equities. I would be waiting for a retracement, at least back to that top of that channel before committing any new funds.
Now, let's talk about where we go from there, because it seems to me, if I just look at this chart from a technical analysis standpoint, you've got this channel that has been operative here since the beginning of 2009. That's, you know, more than a decade.
Yeah.
You've got a very clear upside breakout. What technical analysis tells me is to expect a pullback back to test the top of the channel, now not as resistance, but support. That's exactly what you've got for number 3. And if that support holds, that would be a confirmation of that breakout and suggest that you're headed much higher from there. Is that your view?
That is my view. As of right now, that is my view. Now, again, this doesn't mean that I'm going to go all in on equities at number 3, right? I will keep my exposure to equities, and I'll probably add to it at those levels. But if that channel were to break and it goes lower, then maybe we go back down to the bottom of that red channel. Again, I don't know for sure, but my base case is that we will go back down, test the top of that channel around number 3, and then I think in the years ahead that we are going to go much higher in both the S&P and the Dow. again, you've heard me talk about this before, Eric. I think that we're going to enter a period of sovereign debt crisis. And I think when sovereign debt starts to get sold, those funds are going to look for a home. And I think one of the biggest and most liquid markets on the planet is U.S. equities. And I think that will get fund flows. And I think that equities have the potential to go much higher than anybody believes possible. Now, again, I just want to caution. That doesn't mean you need to go out and go all in on equities right now here today. I think we're going to get a pullback. But for anyone who thinks that we're going to go down to 200 on the S&P and stay there for 10 years, that's not my base case. I don't think that's going to happen. Can't rule it out, but that's not what I'm planning on. I think we're going to see much higher levels in equities in the years ahead.
I don't think I've ever seen a chart with a 30-year long head and shoulders pattern on it until we get to slide 28 here.
Isn't that crazy? So, you know, I've shown this to a few people, and I really, really like long-term charts. I don't know if it's just a visual thing or what, but this is about as symmetrical of a long-term chart as you're going to get. Now, the interesting thing, Eric, is when I was here last year, we were actually sitting at the bottom of that kind of shaded channel. And so, and I thought that that might actually act as resistance. Now, it broke through there. Now, it's kind of come up to kind of the top of the of this shaded area. And again, this is not necessarily technical analysis on this right here. I just kind of highlighted kind of the long-term level here. I, again, because I believe that, you know, we're going to move into kind of a disinflationary environment and potentially even a deflationary environment, I am not participating fully or aggressively, for lack of a better word, in the commodities. I think a lot of people are just convinced inflation is here and are going all in, quote unquote, on the commodity trade. And I'm just not there yet. That said, the one area of commodities where I am extremely interested and am going and am looking to add positions on pullbacks aggressively is the soft commodities. And I think I've put a number of charts here over the next pages, I think from like, you know, slide 29 through 32 or 33 of a number of different soft commodities. And the reason I put these in here, Eric, is, you know, soft commodities, for lack of a better word, have been not necessarily in a bear market, but just kind of a sideways market for a long time. They had some big runs, you know, coming out of the global crisis in 2008 and 2009, but then they kind of slipped back and they haven't really done anything for a long time. But I am of the belief that even if we don't get this runaway inflation in overall commodities that a lot of other people are predicting, and even though I think it's very possible that some of the industrial commodities pull back and maybe even stay down for a while, I'm not sure that that's the case with the soft commodities. And part of the reason is, regardless of what's going on in the economy, you still got to eat. People still have to eat. So I think the demand for food is going to be there. And I think we could continue to have some supply shortages in food. And so I think that could be a recipe for higher prices. And so if, you know, page 29, I have this is the chart of coffee. Coffee had a huge breakout, you know, went all the way up to almost like 220, 225. And now it's pulled back to the, you know, the high, I think 170s. You know, if that gets back to the 150 range or the 140 range, I would probably start adding to something like coffee. You get a similar chart on slide 31 with soybeans. Soybeans had a huge breakout as well. I mean, it went up 60 or 70%, almost 100% from its lows last summer. But now it's pulled back a little bit. And again, I'm not chasing these commodities higher, Eric, but I've highlighted these channels where I think it gets pretty interesting to own them. And I think to the extent that the people are looking to add some additional diversification to their portfolio or another way to play perhaps the devaluation of fiat currencies, I think the agricultural commodities might be a better way to do it than just the general industrial commodities.
Now, Brent, some people would say, look, you're misinterpreting the COVID crisis. What happened here was we had supply chain disruptions. Obviously, those soft commodities get hard. You know, you can't go out and pick the coffee beans and, yep, and so forth. You know, it must be that. This is a one-off thing. It's an anomaly. Don't read anything more into it, especially if you're not in the secular inflation camp. What would you say to that argument?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. And I think that's why I'm not chasing them higher right now. And that's why when you look at kind of the charts of soybean or coffee or some of these other ones that have had these massive moves, I think a lot of that was due to supply chains. So I don't necessarily disagree. And so I think, you know, when some of that supply chain issue gets worked out, we have the possibility to, you know, to pull back, and in some cases maybe pull back aggressively. But what I would say is that I also am of the belief that demand for these food products is going to stay high. I don't think that supply chains, while they will get better, I don't think they're going to go back to be as efficient and as functional as they were, you know, over the last 20 to 30 years of globalization. I also think what's kind of interesting is that, you know, we've had a number of, there's been a number of issues over the last couple of years regarding different agriculture. You know, China has had a number of problems, whether it's the armyworm attacking their crops or the swine flu attacking their livestock. You know, we've also had some problems with, can't remember the name of this. There's this type of beetle that's been attacking plants in the Midwest now, and that's been affecting crops. And then I also think that we could have, I know global warming is like this very popular thing and, you know, all the green initiatives, but, you know, there's also the possibility that, you know, with these grand solar maximums and minimums that we're going to get into a cycle of cooling temperatures. And if that's the case, maybe harvests aren't quite as robust as they've been for the last 10 or 15 years. So, you know, again, I'm not going to go all in on the agricultures, but I'll just say that they're pretty interesting to me. And that if we do get a pullback on some of these, I'm looking to add positions.
Brent, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please give our listeners just a quick overview of what you do at Santiago Capital and how they can follow your work.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Eric. Well, again, my job is a wealth management professional. I have a group of clients where I do customized long-term portfolios for them. And it's kind of a holistic scenario where we take into account their, you know, their tax situation, their trust and estate plans, you know, their business owners, and how does that play into things. And so what we try to do is create customized long-term portfolios. And then in addition to that, we not only come up with the overall allocation, but then we actually go out and we implement those portfolios and we manage those portfolios for them. In addition to that, as part of a diversified portfolio, we have a private fund that we manage that does some more high risk, high reward, asymmetric type trades. And that's kind of a hedge against the more traditional portfolios. I'm pretty active on Twitter. You can just type in Santiago Capital in the search function and probably find me. My Twitter handle is Santiago AU Fund. I would also encourage people to, you know, continue to listen to Macro Voices. I've been on here a number of times. You can actually search for some of my prior interviews on here, and there were slide decks there. So you can, I got to say, Eric, the great thing about coming on your show is you do a good job of keeping the prior interviews up there and the transcripts and the slide decks. So, you know, all this stuff that we talk about, it's there in black and white, and you know, you can see where you got things right and see where you got things wrong. And I think it's a great way to kind of get a feel for what somebody's all about. So I would encourage people to check out your website to find out more as well.
Thanks so much for that, Brent. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of Freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF, and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Brent back. That interview really inspired me to put together a little chart deck talking about the dollar and all these commodities on a much bigger time frame scale, and looking forward to getting through it all with you.
Well, let's dive right into it. Listeners, the chart deck is titled Big Picture Look at Commodities. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to the homepage, macrovoices.com. Click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, page 2, Dollar Index. What's going on?
I hear a lot of times you referencing this in the market wrap, and then when we talked to Brent about the dollar as well, it really made me want to just zoom out on that chart and really reflect upon where the dollar is in the bigger picture. And when you really observe that through the 1990s and into the 2000s, or at least the first decade of the 2000s, the sheer volatility the dollar index went through was enormous. I mean, we had swings of the dollar index go from 120 down to 70 in a span of like 5+ years. And, we stare at this dollar, and like you were saying, on a relative basis compared to other fiat currencies, but there really has been a lack of dollar trend. I mean, the most we can really identify is that the dollar's been in a very specific trade range between the 90 and 100 level, which is historically a very narrow range for the dollar. And for anyone to be doing a victory lap saying that the dollar bear market is already underway, I think it's quite premature. Now, I'm not trying to even suggest something alternatively overly bullish, but right now, all we can really identify is that there's been a very pronounced trade range since 2014-15, and it's entirely possible that we stay within this range in the coming year. And so that'll be very interesting to see how this develops.
I couldn't agree more, Patrick. And, you know, the way to look at this is we, at the beginning of 2015, 6 years ago, we entered this sideways consolidation pattern on the big chart here, and we're still in it. And there's no great surprise here. And I think we stay in it until there's a clear signal that we're coming out of it. Let's move on now to my favorite chart, crude oil futures. We're down a tick here. What do you make of this chart, Patrick?
Well, down a tick. I mean, this is the continuous chart going back to 1999. And so this is really just reflecting the different cyclicality of oil over that time frame. And while there's always the backdrop based upon the evolving market as to could circumstances arise where oil could once again rise to previous high ranges, like north of 100. And now we certainly have a number of people that have suggested that's on the table. But when we really look at it back to the last 5 years and just that most narrow range, we've approached now the 2017-18 highs and at least temporarily paused along the previous overhead resistance. Maybe there's room for some squiggling as crude oil may, backfill a move towards $60 on a bigger scale. But overall, the most interesting part on this chart will there be a new pronounced oil bull market, which would basically mean that we'd have to break out of this resistance points around 2018, highs of around 75, and then really see a trend resume that could see us heading up to those much higher levels. Do you think that the conditions are there for that kind of a breakout?
Well, I think the conditions for that kind of breakout are coming. I'm not so sure that they're there right now. What we're seeing, to a lot of people's surprise, is actual builds on inventory when we thought there would be massive drawdowns. Now, I think there's a sentiment in the marketplace which is saying, boy, if we can just somehow get through August, that's the big crunch period because that's summer driving season. And once that's over, we're going to be able to breathe a sigh of relief and not have to worry about inventory drawdowns anymore because summer driving season's over. Remember the words of Phil Verleger, the energy economist who is extremely well respected, who told us that summer driving season has always been a myth. What it really is summer home building season. Now, I can attest from just the fact that my contractors won't return my phone calls that the builders are all super busy. They're going to continue summer home building season right through the fall into the winter. So I don't think that we're going to see as much demand drop off after Labor Day, as a lot of analysts expect. Now, I don't know yet that we're going to see a disappointment in August where the market just can't get going because those inventory draws everyone expected never happened. But I wouldn't be at all surprised, even if the price comes off in August, that as we get into September and October, if demand surprises to the upside, as that so-called summer home building season turns into autumn and winter home building season. Let's move on, though, Patrick, to page 4, natural gas futures. What are we looking at here?
You know, it's interesting because Brent inspired me to kind of want to dig in a little farther to see where we are in the cycle on a lot of these different commodities. And natural gas has been in an incredibly pronounced bear market that has more or less been in place since its 2008 highs. I mean, the pre-2008 periods on natural gas have the fundamental backdrop of being able to get up towards $14 on a numerous occasions. But really, in the post 2009 period, natural gas has been bound by more or less a lower boundary of $2 and a upper boundary of, let's say, $5 that encompasses the majority of the price action. And we're slowly edging toward the top of that range. And this is what a common theme that we're going to see on a lot of these charts, which is the question that are these commodities in the cyclical trade range, and they're just going to come to the top end of their range and circle back down, or are we genuinely seeing the beginning of one of these very big, pronounced commodity bull markets? And this is a question that's going to be solved in the coming year. But right now, we're approaching some pretty big overhead resistance levels in the next, 50 cents to a dollar on the upside of nat gas. And it'll be really interesting to see how natural gas reacts once it starts correcting a little bit.
Let's move on to page 5 and gold futures. It kind of looks like a formative cup and handle pattern, doesn't it?
Yeah, and what's really interesting here, Eric, is that gold is one of the very few commodities, after we go through every single one of these charts, that actually has been in a sustained bull market pretty much since 99-2000, right? So many of these commodities have gone through cycles higher and then mean reverted almost 100% of their prior rises. And the only commodity that really hasn't exhibited that behavior has been gold. And even though we've been in what's more or less a half a year consolidation of gold prices, which certainly has taken the wind out of the sails from a sentiment perspective, when you really step back and look at the way this chart has developed, this is still probably the most pronounced bull trend in most commodity charts. And I mean, we're holding at a stone throw away from that 2000 level. I mean, it is, I guess, it's still a couple hundred dollars. But when you look at this chart, this still looks structurally very bullish.
Patrick, I agree on the technicals, and I think the fundamentals are there too. Of course, we do have this issue of crypto and gold competing for the same market share, and I think that's been a big headwind for gold. But I wouldn't be surprised if the bottom is already in. I was hoping for a deeper pullback before this was over, but I'm not sure we're going to get it at this point.
So moving on here, Eric, what I wanted to do is to just circle the silver, the cousin of gold. And what's interesting is that the boom-bust cycle in silver to its 2011 high was much more pronounced. I mean, silver almost wiped out its entire prior 2009-2010 gain in the subsequent bear market that happened in the last decade. But what we really see is that silver had almost a 3-4 year trade range between this kind of more or less $15 to $20 range for the sake of rounding. And this breakout in silver is generally holding at these higher levels. I mean, at this stage, arguably, if this sideways consolidation we've seen here for the last half a year bullishly breaks out with a new high, this could send silver heading up towards testing some of those previous highs around $35 or more. It'll be really interesting to see whether silver will in the coming half a year break out bullishly to the upside.
It'll be very interesting indeed, Patrick. I can't help but look at this and say, you know, there's a whole lot of silly money that went running into silver on the Wall Street bets. You know, it's going to, what was it, 1,000? You know, that stuff. When those folks figure out that that was kind of silly, I think that potentially there's a big wave of selling that creates a buying opportunity. We'll see what happens. I don't think that those guys are going to get their $1,000 price anytime soon, though.
generally, if your narrative comes out, I mean, I think it would still be structurally very bullish if all pullbacks on the silver stayed above 20, right? Where all the previous highs of that multi-year consolidation occurred, so long as silver had a short-term correction and let's say it dropped, 10-15% in a sell cycle, found solid lows, that would be still conditions that would allow a bull market phase to ensue on the other side.
Oh, I'd be buying a lot sooner than 20. I'd be buying 22 hand over fist, but I do think that pullback could be coming for that reason. Let's move on to copper futures. This is another one where I hope the pullback's not over yet, because I wish I had more exposure and don't want to buy it at these prices.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, copper hit a multi-decade high when it punched through $4.50 earlier this year, but it did have an enormous move on the upside, and that rally is now being checked. It reminds me a lot of the pullback in 2009-2010 after copper made that huge move off the low. It paused there and mean reverted a good chunk, but that was only a midpoint before the continuation pattern. It'll be really interesting to see whether these pullbacks are more or less contained above $4 on copper in the bigger picture. If they are, I mean, that could be the buy on dip consolidation that allows copper to bust to all-time new highs and run pretty hard. But the observation here, which I think is the most important one to make, is there isn't much asymmetry in buying brand new copper positioning up here without, let's say, having some sort of option strategy to hedge it out. The tricky part is that while there's a very easy case to be made to be bullish copper, it's actually quite challenging to manage the risk on it. If you didn't get in on the copper bull market when it broke out $3 going back a year, it really is a much trickier entry here at these levels.
Patrick, I couldn't agree more, and I certainly don't want to be putting new money to work in a naked long here. I agree with you. You've got to have a hedge strategy if you're going to enter this market here. I'm personally hoping for a deeper pullback so I can get that long-term long position in place. Let's move on to a topic Brent mentioned in this interview, which is he thinks that if there's a pullback, soft commodities, he thinks, may be the place to play. I see you've got a series of soft commodity charts here.
Well, I figure we throw them all up, at least the major ones, just to kind of put some context on the moves that happened and the potential moves still to come. And what's interesting, just to step back, and I attached articles to our research roundup, Felder report one where he shows where Jesse Felder puts up that generational opportunity commodities chart, which is taking the commodity index divided by the industrial index to show just on a ratio basis how cheap commodities are to the general asset prices. And while, you can make the argument that commodities are cheap, when you look at the individual commodities themselves, it's interesting to see how far they've already come and what it would mean for a new bull market to ensue in many of these. And so I wanted to start here on page 8 with the wheat futures and looking at just, I chose two of the grains, wheat and soybean. And what we have here is there was a number of periods a decade ago that saw wheat prices temporarily advance up to levels in the 8-9 level on the upside, 800-900 on this chart. But almost each time it was like the lumber chart where it was some short-term supply-demand imbalance that basically corrected itself and caused wheat prices to mean revert back to much more average prices. And this is going to be the interesting storyline here. First of all, there is room for these grains to generally advance still to higher levels. I mean, we have had essentially a sequence of higher highs and higher lows in bull trend, and there's no evidence that this trend has already stopped. But really the question here is, is this simply going to be a short-term trend move that is going to be emergent, and or is it going to be much more like the gold chart where once it reaches higher levels, it's going to sustain up there for extended periods of time? And that's one of the bigger questions as to whether or not even inflation is transitory versus whether inflation is here to stay, is whether or not a lot of these commodities are simply structurally going to find much higher prices on a sustained basis. And watching with the breakout on wheat and on the next page, the soybean is the same thing. Like soybean is basically already traded to multi-decade highs. And so really to be bullish the beans for a bull market would mean that it's a bold call that these highs that were in place for the last decade are going to be broken, and somehow we're about to see a sustained new bull advance, which is not impossible. I mean, we saw in things like lumber, but that's pretty much what the call you'll have to be making right now if this is where you're starting your buying.
Well, I'm reminded of Darius Dale's interview a few weeks back and just what we know in general about markets, which is I think this is the beginning of a really big inflation. What happens in the beginning of something really big? There's a great big panic move up, and then everybody realizes that it was a little bit too much, too fast. It was overblown. And you see a great big retracement, maybe a 61.8 Fib retracement typically in that situation. And then that secular trend resumes. So I think Darius probably has it right that, you know, the first panic wave has already played out. And now we're in the retracement before the resumption of what will ultimately be a huge bull market. What do you think of that view?
It's entirely possible. I mean, right now, I think what I was trying to achieve with this is simply seeing where we are in terms of a new opportunities on a lot of these commodities. I feel that if the right fundamental backdrop is there for general repricing, but I think the part that you've alluded to in previous shows is about the social unrest that could happen if we did see this type of a commodity move. I mean, really, it hits these types of commodities, that really ends up hitting the grocery stores. That really ends up hitting the average person that hasn't seen a meaningful pay raise in a long period of time. And right now, these commodities, you know, while most of us have seen generally rising prices in the grocery stores, we haven't seen anything extraordinary. But if these soft commodities really start to bull run, I think that it's going to really be felt. I mean, it's going to be hard for it not to be felt in the pricing of on the grocery bill, right?
Patrick, let's move on to page 10 and continue our review of soft commodities with cocoa futures.
Right. And it's interesting. This commodity has actually been the most trade range bound. I mean, while we've seen a number of commodities that have demonstrated cyclicality, this is really, especially in the last 3 years, been in an incredibly tight range. We're trading at least to several year lows, or at least approaching it. It'll be interesting to see whether or not this, like a ping pong, just is bouncing between these trade ranges and a buying opportunity emerges here on these. So Eric, though, what I wanted to do is move on to page 11, where I have the chart on cotton futures. And what's particularly interesting here is cotton back in 2011 had a parabolic rise that was very reminiscent of what just has been happening with lumber, and just had this really big squeeze that had almost immediately mean reverted. But when you remove that one kind of outlier, you can define cotton as a trade range that more or less has stayed within the $50 to $100 range for several decades now. And we are trading right to that top of that trade range. And what an amazing crossroad this is on the cotton futures, because exactly like we were talking, is this transitory? Is this just temporary? Are we going to just hit the top of this range and trade back to the middle or bottom end of this range? Or do we have a breakout to almost a decade high with a breakout, let's say, to 100 or more, and see a new commodity bull trend emerge on the weekly charts this way? It's really interesting to see where cotton is today, and it'll be interesting to see whether that breakout actually does play out.
Now, look at the contrast in orange juice futures on page 12. We're nowhere close to the cyclical highs or the recent all-time highs.
Absolutely. And what is interesting, though, is that when you really step back and look at the behavior, this is one of the few softs that actually looks like you can get in at an asymmetric level. I mean, we had quite an extensive multi-year bear market in orange juice futures that saw it go from 220 to under 100. And for the first time in the last year, we have seen the characteristics of basing formations and higher highs start to establish. It'd be interesting to see whether orange juice futures are just breaking out of the gate here. That this is probably, out of all of the commodities, this one from a technical perspective looks the closest to being at the starting point of a new trend. It'll be interesting to see whether this breakout actually sticks.
Let's move on to coffee futures, Patrick. What's going on here?
Now, coffee has had an extraordinary run in the last 6 months. I mean, we've all seen coffee futures almost double off of their 2020 lows. And we've seen in the past that when coffee gets going, it can actually have a sustained trend. Now, obviously, it's hard to justify a brand new position after such an extraordinary move on the upside. But it'll be really interesting to see whether, as it mean reverts and corrects, whether old dips are being bought and whether there's another leg higher coming in these coffee futures. If you're looking for something that is just building momentum to the upside, this is definitely one of the futures to watch.
Now, take a look at lumber futures with that downside retracement continuing to the point where now lumber futures are literally trading at one-third of the price they peaked at just a few months ago.
And this brings me back to that cotton chart on page 11. And when you see these kind of huge runs on the upside and then the full mean reversions, clearly lumber is going to be impacted by inflation. And generally, higher lumber prices make sense. But when you really put it in perspective, for several decades, the $200 to $400 range has contained lumber prices for, like you're saying, for several decades. And the fact that we had this extraordinary move was very much, I think, a nature of the illiquidity of this market and the, some short-term supply and demand imbalances that ensued. But what will be really interesting to see is that now that lumber is settling down a little bit after its extraordinary pop and drop, the question now is, does it stabilize at structurally higher prices? And I would say that even if we saw a short-term pullback even to 400, so long as we see 400 to 600 be the new higher trade range, that's still a substantially higher price of lumber than we have historically seen. And while I think I'm a seller on the idea that lumber is imminently going to head back to north of 1,000, we finally are seeing lumber reverting back to levels where one can entertain the idea of buying dips again.
Finally, on page 15, we've got sugar futures. What do we make of this chart?
Another one of these soft commodities that, you know, more or less has been in a pronounced bear market for pretty much the last decade. We put some major lows in around the $10 level over the 2015 to 2020 period. And for the first time, we broke to a higher high, beating those 2019-2020 highs in this recent advance. And while it's a little bit of a chase buying sugar at this moment, it'll be interesting to see whether this is now the beginning of a new potential bull run in sugar. If dips continue to be bought here, maybe we can see prices north of 20 and heading toward 25 on the top end of the range. So this is certainly another one of these softs that is going to be interesting to see as it develops here in the coming weeks and months.
Listeners, you can get Patrick's chart decks every single day with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. Information's on page 16 or at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show.
This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow.
Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the slide deck provided by Brent and the chart book we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a link to a Jesse Felder report on the generational opportunity in commodities part deux, as well as an article titled, Maybe It's Not Transitory, Let's Try tolerable. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.